Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com. Recorded live from the lobby of the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C.
Welcome to the Big Life Podcast on Full Service Radio. We are Lina Salazar
and Ingrid Vaishus,
broadcasting live from the lobby of the Lion Hotel in Washington, D.C. The Big Life brings inspiring people to talk about their stress story and what they learned from making changes. We also sit with experts, therapists, scientists, and holistic professionals who shed light on the effects of stress on our well-being and give us the tools to live bigger, more fulfilling lives. I am Lina Salazar, a health coach and the creator of the Food Sanity Program. I work with women whose main source of stress is their relationship with food and their bodies, and companies that believe in meditation as a resource for employee well-being.
And I'm Ingrid Vaishus, also a health coach. I help women who are stressed out, overwhelmed, and burned out prioritize their health and wellness so they can lead more effectively and live more fulfilling lives.
I'm very excited about this show today. We're going to talk about a topic that's near and dear to me and a main focus of my food sanity program, weight stigma. Internalized weight stigma and bias is a barrier to a healthy, sane relationship with food and our bodies. It is for the women I work with, and it was for me when I struggled with an eating disorder for many years. Weight stigma is pervasive. Fat people face discrimination in the workplace, the media, educational institutions, and in healthcare settings. Ingrid and I are very intentional in bringing to the table topics that are overlooked in conversations about health and well-being. So today, we're going to talk about weight stigma, its effects on health, and what to do about it. And to do that, we are joined by Dr. Kendrin Sonville, a doctor of science and registered dietitian. She's an assistant professor at the University of Michigan School of Public Health and holds an adjunct appointment at Harvard Medical School and is a collaborating mentor for the Strategic Training Initiative for the prevention of eating disorders at Boston's Children's Hospital and the Harvard School of Public Health. Her research focuses on the prevention of eating disorders and weight-inclusive approaches to health. Our other guest is my friend Patrilli Hernandez, a body liberation advocate that promotes weight-neutral health practices in order to prevent disorder eating, negative body image, and improve mental health. Patrilli holds a Master of Science and has more than 12 years of experience working as an educator in the health and nutrition field. In her 9-to-5, Patrilli works with the DC early childhood community in educating young children who are confident in their relationship with food, health, and their bodies. Love it. Kendrin, Patrilli, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us. It's a huge honor to be a part of this.
Likewise. Thank you so much, Lina. It's always great getting together with you and talking about things like this and chatting. So,
awesome. Yes,
thank you both.
No problem. So I'm excited, too, because this is something that I am aware of, but I'm definitely learning more and more as I go and I work with clients. So I think the best place to start, maybe we can start with you, Kendrin, is to talk about what is weight stigma.
Sure. So weight stigma is stereotyping or discrimination that a person experiences based on their size. People with higher body weights are those that are facing the most weight stigma. Weight stigma also is, or also can manifest as a fear of becoming fat. Mm-hmm. And so that is the type of stigma that we see thinner body people sort of experiencing and internalizing of sort of behaviors that they do or sort of things that they think to prevent themselves from ever becoming fat or from gaining weight.
Wow, that's, I hadn't really ever thought about it that way. So that's really interesting. How common is weight stigma, you would say?
So extremely common. About 40% of U.S. adults report ever having experienced weight-based discrimination. And if you think about the weight distribution of the U.S. population, it's surprising that that many are experiencing weight-based discrimination. It's also the most commonly cited type of bullying that's experienced by youth in this country and several other countries. There's some research that looks at cross-cultural differences, it is the most common type of bullying that youth are facing.
Kendrine, before we move on to Patrilli, I want to ask you another question. How does weight stigma look in real life? Like, give us a few examples so we can touch it, let's say.
Yeah. So it manifests in lots of different ways. So the sort of insidious way that it manifests is in what people think or feel when they see people with higher body weight. So it's the stereotypes that folks hold about people with large bodies. We make assumptions about their health behaviors, about their character, about their work ethic. And when you have those stereotypes, that influences how you are treating other people. So teasing, bullying, and harassment is one type of weight stigma that we see, this really overt form of weight stigma. You can also see weight stigma come out in social interactions through rejection or ostracism, people like kids not wanting to be friends with their heavier peers, people not being willing to date people with larger bodies. And then there's this whole range of experiences that I like to call weight-related microaggression. So it's just this constant chatter that we have in our environment where we are complimenting people because of weight loss, or talking about lower body or lower-weighted bodies as better bodies or more desirable, the way that we just make thin bodies the default and hold them up in the highest regard. That is sort of the most probably pervasive and insidious forms of weight stigma.
I think you gave us a very clear picture of what weight stigma is and how does it look in real life. Patrilli, you are a body liberation advocate. Explain what this is and how has weight stigma impacted your own life? Please.
Great. That's a great question. Thank you so much. So body liberation is I'm not going to say it's a framework, but it's a school of thought, right, that has emerged from the umbrella of the body positivity movement. And it was really first coined and examined, if you don't mind me reading a quote of like what kind of spawned the body liberation movement. It's been around, but it was coined by a famous fat activist by the name of Jess Baker in her book Land Whale. And in it, towards the end of the book, she says that liberation is not having to love your body all of the time. Liberation is not asking permission to be included in society's ideal of beauty. Liberation is bucking the concept of beauty currency altogether. Liberation is recognizing the systemic issues that surround us and acknowledging that perhaps we're not able to fix them all on our own. Liberation is personally giving ourselves permission to live life. Liberation is slowly learning how to become the best version of our whole selves, body included. Body liberation doesn't mean you have to love your body. Body liberation allows you to make peace with your body so you can live your life unapologetically. So I have a personal connection to this book because I was reading it while I was in eating disorder recovery. So a little background about me. As you mentioned, Lena, I have worked in the health and nutrition field as an educator, advocate, and policy analyst for about 12 years. It wasn't until I was diagnosed with an eating disorder in 2017 that I fully realized how much my own disordered behaviors and thoughts around food and bodies infiltrated all aspects of not only my personal life, but my career, especially being in the health and nutrition field. So I've been in recovery since then, and going to treatment was a life-changing experience for me. It's still a daily struggle, but I'm able to use my own journey contribute to the body liberation movement, which is different than body positivity in the sense that it is allowing us to examine and dismantle our own internal oppression, right? So that might manifest as what the doctor was saying before about internalized fat phobia, which is our own fear of becoming fat,
yes,
our own discomfort in our bodies, our own question of self-worth. So how do we dismantle that? How do we examine that in order to tackle the bigger systemic issues? Because We look at weight stigma from a personal issue on how other people treat us, but another part of weight stigma is how it's reflected in institutions. So look at the size of chairs in movie theaters or the size of chairs in airplane seats. There are weight limits, you know, on a lot of healthcare equipment. So how is weight stigma, how is weight discrimination being reflected on a larger issue? On a larger scale outside of our own. So this is something that I became very passionate about, and I wanted to become not only an advocate for food policy, but for body liberation, for the ability for us to free ourselves from the cuffs, right, of our own thoughts and our own disordered behaviors in order to be a better advocate for those systemic changes.
Thank you for sharing your experience, Patrilli, and being so open about it, because it's in that vulnerability that we're able to help others, right?
Yes, absolutely. And you tell your story and you're able to reach one person. That's the whole reason why we do it.
Our main goal, Ingrid and I, we have a goal with this podcast, and it's raising awareness and educating people about weight stigma and about the effects of weight stigma. And both you, Patrilli, and Kendrin have talked about how that looks in real life. And the healthcare setting is particularly weight stigma is particularly pervasive in the healthcare setting. So, Kendrin, this is a question for you. What does the research say about the psychological and physiological effects of weight stigma in the healthcare setting?
It's a great question, and I just want to echo exactly what Patrilli just said about our physical environment being hostile to people with large bodies, because I think nowhere is that more common or problematic than in the healthcare setting. She mentioned sort of equipment isn't designed for fat bodies. Chairs aren't designed for fat bodies in healthcare settings, and that sends a signal to patients when you're thinking about the healthcare setting that their bodies are unusual and they don't belong. And so the weight stigma that people experience in that setting, I think, is particularly problematic. So what we know about the experience of weight stigma is that it is physiologically and psychologically stressful. So people who experience weight stigma are more likely to have depression, anxiety, low self-esteem, poor body image, substance abuse, a whole host of psychological consequences. We also see a change in their physiological stress and in their metabolic health. So being exposed to stigma increases cortisol, it increases markers of inflammation, things like C-reactive protein. So it actually is directly linked to poor metabolic health. And we're always making these assumptions that weight is related to poor metabolic health, without sort of thinking about the experience, the lived experience of people with large bodies and the extent to which some of that association is most certainly attributed to this pervasive experience of weight stigma.
Yeah, that's very... and that talks about sort of like the effects of stress on the actual weight gain, right? Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so it's a little bit of a... I don't know if a vicious cycle is the right way to describe it, but weight stigma does, in fact, contribute to a whole host of consequences that ultimately do probably contribute to weight gain, right? So it's the experience of psychological distress. There are also impacts of weight stigma on health behaviors. So we see that weight stigma associated with an increase in binge eating, increase in use of disorder weight control behaviors, a reduction in exercise motivation. When you are experiencing weight stigma, you're motivated to avoid stigmatizing spaces like places where you might exercise, also the doctor's office, but all places where you exercise. And then these physiological consequences that I mentioned, all of these things come together to contribute to weight gain, which leads to more weight stigma. And so I don't want to phrase weight stigma as inherently unhealthy, because that's sort of a weight bias way of framing the problem to begin with. But just to say that for people who think that shaming people because of their weight, people who think that being stigmatizing towards people with high body weight is somehow helpful, that is definitely not the case, right? It is definitely sort of counteracting what they think they might be doing, that weight stigma is harming health, is leading to poor health behaviors, and ultimately probably extra weight gain and then more weight stigma.
Yeah,
I think you touched upon this briefly, but I would love to know what the correlation between weight bias and the incidence of eating disorders and disordered eating? I mean, you touched upon it briefly, but I would love to hear more about that.
Yeah, so exactly that. People who experience weight stigma and people who internalize that weight stigma. So that's an interesting to kind of flag. Patrilli commented on this a little bit, but there is this internalization of stigma that happens in people with larger bodies, and that's sort of unique-ish to the experience of weight stigma. Typically, people who belong in marginalized groups understand that their group shouldn't be experiencing stigma because of that identity, and that's sort of not true of a lot of people with larger body weights. They sort of blame themselves for being high-weighted. They believe that they should be treated poorly. They want not to be in that marginalized group, and so the internalization of that experience, the dislike of one's own body, becomes more stressful, right? You are sort of internalizing the stress of that experience, and both the experience of weight stigma and the internalization of weight stigma is associated with poor body image, binge eating, and disordered eating. And that is why when we look, at least in the research that I've done in college students in particular, if you look across all demographic characteristics, age, gender, race, ethnicity, academic major, just all sorts of characteristics, the thing that is most predictive of eating disorder risk is weight. It's the highest weight students who have the most eating disorders that are at highest risk of eating disorders. So it is this experience of living in a large body that actually is really putting people at risk for disordered eating and its consequences.
Yeah, and I think it's important to clarify something. You, at the beginning, or to emphasize that point that you made at the beginning, which is that internalized fat phobia and internalized weight bias, it's not only for fat people,
no.
Right? It's like, mm-hmm. it's precisely people
everybody.
In every every type of body. Let's say that discrimination is mm-hmm. most felt when you live in a larger body.
That's
but
right.
It affects, it's been internalized by people in every in any type, shape or size, body yep. size. Mm-hmm. And that is a good segue into kids, mm-hmm. Patrilli. Mm-hmm. You work with kids. Mm-hmm. So how does weight stigma look like in kids? Because we are not born thinking
not.
That fat is bad.
Absolutely not. These are learned behaviors mm-hmm. That are promoted by the environment and about the behaviors of the adults we see around us. So we know that institutionalized weight stigma negatively impact mental health and increases toxic stress. Dr.
Sonneville. Well, Kendra.
Yes, Kendra.
Dr. Kendra
talked about the physiological factors that effects that are factored into when we talk about weight stigma. But when we look at weight stigma and weight discrimination in school-age children, in young children, we do see a correlation between weight bias and weight stigma and disordered eating behaviors, related self-harm practices, and poor body image mm-hmm. in children. There have been some studies that have been funded and published over the past few years saying children as young as 5 years old are starting to have these experiences and are starting to have these views about their own body. You can say this is largely attributed to the environment created and the behaviors that are modeled when it comes to food, physical activity, and overall health. We're seeing an increase in the number of kids and teens that are reporting body dissatisfaction. We know that higher body dissatisfaction, no matter what size you are, is correlated with poor quality of life, psychological distress, and also puts you more at risk of unhealthy eating behaviors yeah. and eating disorders.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? Like, what mm-hmm. does weight stigma do in terms of your relationship, kids' relationship to food and mm-hmm. how they view their bodies?
When you are, the way children learn, especially in early childhood, I work in early childhood, mm-hmm. Behaviors are adapted in children specifically through role modeling. So what they see adults do, children are going to internalize that and say that, okay, this is how I should function in society. Mm-hmm. And so when they're seeing adults role modeling behaviors around their bodies and around their foods, kids are going to pick up on that and they're going to say, okay, well, this is normal.
this is the way to belong to
right,
society.
Right.
This is
right,
how I conform.
Right, right.
And this is acceptable
right.
behavior.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so these types of negative views about your body and these complicated relationships with food that you do a lot in your work, Lena, start young.
Yep.
Start young. I mean, there are genetic factors that play into the development of eating disorders. But when we talk about disordered eating behaviors, we can attribute a lot of those to environmental causes. And so a lot of the times, the disordered eating behaviors, those with exhibited disordered eating behaviors through food restriction or through dieting, they are at higher risk to develop a full-blown eating disorder, which happened in my case.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, this, I think, is the perfect segue for a break where we'll begin to address how we can go about changing these behaviors, how we can become better advocates, and what we can do to help children and adults in this situation. So we'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Big Life Podcast on Full Service Radio. We are
Ingrid Vaishus
and Lena Salazar, broadcasting live from the lobby of the Line Hotel in Washington, D.C. For those of you who are just joining the conversation, we have been talking to two amazing women about the many negative effects of weight stigma. We are with Kendrine Sonneville from University of Michigan School of Public Health and Patrilli Hernandez, Body Liberation Advocate. Kendrine, I met you this year at a conference on weight-inclusive nutrition.
Yep.
And your presentation was about weight-inclusive care.
Mm-hmm.
What is weight-inclusive care and why is it important?
Yeah, my favorite question.
Yes.
So I guess when I use the word weight-inclusive, I think it's helpful to start with the alternative paradigm, which is
yes.
pretty much the norm, and that is weight-normative care. And in weight normative care, we use weight as a proxy of health.
Mm-hmm.
When we do that, we get things wrong a lot of the time. We reinforce stigma. We're using a really narrow definition of health. There's a lot of limitations to what is our current standard practice, which is weight normative. So I use a weight inclusive framework when I'm talking about health and health promotion. And in weight-inclusive approaches, we use broader determinants of health, and we use patient-centered definitions of health, recognizing what is important for one person is different from another. And we have to let patients identify what makes sense for them in the context of their own lives and what is important to them. So just like a way to think about what is weight-normative versus what is weight-inclusive, in weight-normative approaches, a doctor or a dietitian or another healthcare practitioner might encourage a patient to aim for a certain weight. In weight-inclusive approaches, we think about bodies as being wise, right? And understanding that bodies will seek their natural weight when individuals eat in response to their own internal cues and are not being pulled in one direction or another because of diet culture or messages that tend to be really fat phobic.
Mm-hmm.
In weight normative approaches, food is illegal or good or bad. In weight inclusive approaches, all food is acceptable, right? There's nothing that's off limits. We really prioritize, again, this innate wisdom that we have to feed ourselves. And then finally, in weight normative approaches, we think of physical activity as punitive. You exercise to lose weight. You exercise to not gain weight, to compensate for food you've eaten. And when we think about weight-inclusive approaches, we want food, we want activity to be enjoyable and
mm-hmm.
sustainable and sort of really centering sort of pleasure and, again, this innate wisdom that people have when we are talking about health and health promotion.
Mm-hmm. Patril, I would love to know what are some good practices that we can adopt at home
mm-hmm.
to make weight-inclusive behavior and make it a safe environment for children and adults around food, around their behaviors, their day-to-day.
Yeah, this is actually one of my favorite topics ever. Mm-hmm. I love, so I do a lot of work with families and early childhood and school administrators and staff around this very issue. And I think that a huge reason why I work with the early childhood community is because really the key is to start young. Children come into the world knowing their bodies, knowing how to eat, knowing how to move, and they learn it, and they're nurtured by the adults around them. So what happens as children grow up is that we are unfortunately creating an environment where their own intuitive senses about food and moving are questioned, and then saying, oh, you can't trust yourself. And so basically what I am helping families and the early childcare community do is to learn to rebuild that trusting relationship with their child. So you definitely want to start young. You want to help nurture the child in maintaining competent eating behaviors. So eating competence is a framework and theory developed by Ellen Satter through the Ellen Satter Institute. And so she talks about feeding dynamics, the division of responsibility, which is basically as a child grows, the adult is responsible for providing what to eat and when to eat. And then the child is responsible, and only the child is responsible for deciding how much to eat and if they're going to eat. And I spend hours training educators on unlearning all of the things that we were taught when mm-hmm. we were young, because how many of us were taught to clean our plates mm-hmm. or that we have to at least try one bite, or we have to eat our vegetables first, or if we don't have if we don't eat our dinner, then we can't have dessert, or we have to eat the same thing the next way. These are all what we've been up to culturally, and I think it's really impacted the way that we view food in our bodies. And so it's talking about that. It's about linking physical health behaviors, so movement, food, not only linking it to the shape and size of our body, but how it relates to other aspects of health, right? How does it play into supporting our emotional health, our mental health, and other aspects of wellness? We can promote positive body image through modeling positive body image behaviors. So I see this a lot. You know, I'm a woman, and we learn a lot about how to review our bodies from the other women in our lives growing up. So if you are struggling with body image, that is, believe it or not, going to impact your child. And so I always say, start with your own body image first, and then they'll pick up on that. You don't have to nurture theirs. They'll know how to nurture it by you nurturing yourselves. Also, another thing is celebrate body diversity. Children are naturally curious. They're going to notice differences. They're going to notice, you know, how people react to these differences. So how are we responding to these situations when a child points out somebody that might look like they're not used to, right? How do we handle these situations with grace and with care while allowing the child to stay curious, right? So I think those are just a few of those things, you know. I know Kendra talked about developing more of a neutral relationship with food. You know, all foods fit. Food is not morally good or bad. It nourishes us in different ways, and we have to learn to develop a trusting relationship with our bodies to be able to tell us to what kinds of foods our body needs. Yeah.
And I think the key is, and bringing it back to sort of like that, what Kendrin explained about weight not being a proxy for health and weight inclusive approaches, I think it all comes down to, I see it as like a lens, like a pair of reading glasses that you wear, right? If you're wearing sort of like the weight focused, weight centered glasses, I'm seeing everything in terms of like, will it make me thin? Will it make me fat? Etc. Even like including exercise. Mm-hmm. And when I'm wearing the weight inclusive glasses, right? The focus is my well-being mm-hmm. and how do I care for my body, right. regardless of weight loss and regardless of right. my shape and size.
Right.
So it's more focused on modifiable behaviors, mm-hmm. right, that you can improve in time rather than weight or a number on the scale.
Right, and I think it's about, you know, we talk about this trust in our body and trusting our feelings, trusting how our body responds, you know. I think with movement and with exercise, we push our bodies where it doesn't feel good, you know. Mm-hmm. Movement should feel joyful, should feel, in a way, makes you not only feel good physically, but emotionally and mentally. And I think a lot of the times people miss that.
Yeah.
I feel like what I do see a lot with the clients that I work with is there's this weight scent, right? They come to me to lose weight, and I'm like, but wait, have you done blood work? What does your blood work look like? Oh no, it's good. Do you have energy? Are you sleeping well? Mm-hmm. So there's so many other markers, exactly. And I think that it gets lost in the conversation at some point. Like I've even had, and I would love to hear input from both of you, when you have a person in a heavier body go to the doctor and everything looks good, but the doctor keeps pushing, you need to lose weight.
Yeah. That was my experience mm-hmm. for a very long time. I know people can't see me, but I identify as a large body and someone that has experienced a lot of weight stigma in the healthcare setting, both with eating disorder treatment, which I think is a whole other episode. And also with primary care. Even though health markers are acceptable, there's a system that's been created that make weight such an important factor. And I used to, you know, place a lot of blame on the actual practitioner, but then you start looking at the actual system and the role that insurance companies play, that health finance management play in making BMI and weight a central factor in assessing health. I think this just goes all back to personal behaviors and personal feelings about weight stigma, but how it's reflected on a larger systemic basis that reinforce those internal kind of feelings about weight stigma. So yeah, it's a cycle.
I appreciate what you said there in terms of sort of the systemic reasons why we see so much weight bias mm-hmm. in clinical practice. So, you know, doctors and other healthcare providers tend to have really good intentions, right? Mm-hmm. They go into Absolutely. Their careers because they want to help people. They are victims of the same society that we all live in, which is inherently weight biased, and it's really hard not to internalize those messages. Mm-hmm. And then training in medical schools, training for dietitians, training for other healthcare providers is weight normative. Mm-hmm. That is a training that they get. They feel like if I'm not bringing up weight with my patients, I'm not doing my job, mm-hmm. that I'm somehow doing harm. And I think more and more research is coming out that this weight normative care is what's doing harm, right? Mm-hmm. It's not talking about weight that's actually harmful. It's not ignoring it. But medical school curricula have not caught up with that emerging research. And so I think doctors mm-hmm. are acting on the information that they received, and hopefully that's sort of the future of medical training, is recognizing how much weight bias plays into the health of their higher weight patients. And then on top of that, this notion that recommending weight loss is going to be helpful is another myth we really have to debunk, because for the vast majority of people, sustained weight loss is not possible. The most common outcome of weight loss dieting is weight regain. Mm-hmm. And we know that weight cycling or yo-yo dieting or weight loss and regain is in and of itself really physiologically stressful. Mm-hmm. And this is a way that we do harm. When we tell people mm-hmm. you need to lose weight, when we provide really simple solutions, oh, do you know you need to eat less or lose more or eat more?
Eat less, move more.
I have to close my eyes. Yeah, it's so ridiculous. I can't remember what it is anymore. This sort of eat less, move more.
That's a good sign, I guess.
Right? Every fat person has been on a million diets and knows this. Mm-hmm. And when we offer these really simple solutions, it really minimizes how much weight is more complicated and is socially mm-hmm. determined and genetically determined, and the extent to which we can modify it is actually pretty small.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And if I can just peg off that, I just wanted to say that doing body liberation work and being a body liberation advocate means going into your health practitioner's office and saying and standing up and saying, this is not how I want to receive care. And you'd be surprised that once you speak up and you have the research and a lot of doctors are actually willing to listen, because I think that a big reason why we haven't seen these large-scale changes in the system when it comes to medical care is because there aren't enough patients speaking up and saying that this is causing me harm. Yeah. This is not benefiting me mentally and psychologically. And I think the more people that get educated on that, and the more people that speak up for themselves and say, this is not healthy for me, I think the medical community is going to respond to that better.
Yeah, I agree. I've had, sorry, Kendrin, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but it's just, I want to bring to the table the fact that I've had actually worked with women who are in fat, in larger bodies, and they haven't been to the doctor in 2 years because they fear the shame, being fat shamed by their doctors, because last time their goal and the commitment, quote unquote, was to lose weight. And then it makes you think, right? Why are they getting sick? Because they are fat, mm-hmm. or because they haven't been to the doctor in 2 years?
Yeah, access to health.
So in that sense, I would love. I don't know, Kendra, if this is what the comment that you were gonna make, but I would love to hear from both of you. How can, I mean, Patrilli has talked a little bit about that in the doctor's office, but how can people in smaller bodies also advocate for body liberation?
Gosh, this is such a hard question. I think the first part of the question about health, or the point that you made about healthcare avoidance, that is well established, that people in larger bodies are delaying healthcare appointments because they're going to be told to lose weight. They're worried that they've gained weight. They don't want to get on a scale. That these experiences are stressful. Doctors maybe might assume, like, this is the first time this person is hearing this information about their weight. It is not, right? It is absolutely not. And realizing, again, that this these microaggressions that people are experiencing in doctors' offices are harming the health of people in larger bodies or fat people. So I think that is, we cannot emphasize it enough, and I think that's information that we need to be getting to medical school curriculum. Mm-hmm. In terms of what smaller body people can do to advocate for this issue, I think center the voice of fat people, right? Mm-hmm. If you don't have lived experience, I think, unfortunately, your perspectives are more acceptable for some reason. I'm a smaller bodied researcher who does weight stigma research, and I understand that people listen to me because mm-hmm. of the size of my body, and that's really frustrating. Mm-hmm. But it is unfortunately the reality of our weight bias society. And so I speak up in spaces where it would be less acceptable for larger body people to do it. But then I also center the voices of my students who are larger bodied, of my patients who are larger bodied, to make sure that I am not sort of watering down a message mm-hmm. or pretending that I'm the best messenger of these messages. Mm-hmm. You know, I teach a course called Weight Bias and Health at my university, and brought in a whole bunch of different speakers. But one speaker I brought in was Reagan Chastain, who is a fat mm-hmm. advocate, and she's phenomenal. And she provided my students, a lot of whom, or many of whom, are smaller bodied, sort of with her experience, and provided lots of kind of advice and feedback about what we can do in our own training, in our own clinical practice, in our own advocacy work, if you are someone who doesn't have lived experience. And she, you know, she speaks in sound bites. She's like so brilliant. But she, one thing she said is to remind people that there's no disease that affects only fat people, mm-hmm. not one.
Yes.
Right. And that if you are someone who is larger bodied and only getting advice to lose weight, to tell your provider, what would you tell a thin person mm-hmm. with a condition? Like, don't withhold this good treatment that exists because mm-hmm. all you can see is my body. What is actually the evidence-based treatment for this condition? Mm-hmm. And sort of pushing providers to provide the same service to higher weight people as they would to thinner weight patients.
Wow. Yeah. I completely agree with you, and I'm also very careful because I am like a I don't know, like a tiny girl, very short, but I feel like, as a health coach who works with women who struggle with body image and food issues, women of all sizes, shape and sizes, I see my, it's my duty to sort of like educate them about this. It's like, listen, it's not about the food. It's about the way you think. Mm-hmm. And when we have internalized this weight bias, that is a precursor, let's say, for you to fight your body. Mm-hmm. So once you sort of like uncover these bias and so ingrained and internalized, it will be easier for you to make peace with food and your body. And educating and spreading that message, sort of like removing the, how do you say, the blind, the blinders on like horses' eyes. Exactly. Mm-hmm. It seems to me like that it's like that.
I feel like it's empowering, but it also lifts a huge weight off their shoulders to look at the world differently, right? That does not define them. There's so much more.
Yeah. Because once you're not judging people in larger bodies, you're also easier on yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
I think we could go on for a really long time. This is such a good conversation. It's so juicy. But we need to start wrapping it up. And so at the end of every show, we ask our guests the following questions. So we'd love to hear what your answers are. What does living a big life look like for you?
Should I go first?
Yeah,
sure. So I was thinking about this question, and I thought about my work with my students. You know, mm-hmm. I recognize I'm a researcher. The thing you work towards when you are a researcher is getting papers published and hopefully getting people to read those papers. But my impact, no matter how excited I am about my own research, is just is limited. And the work that I do with my students is how I think I'm able to live a big life, because my work might be a drop in the bucket, but I, through mentoring them, they are continuing doing this good work and studying weight normative versus weight inclusive care and understanding paradigm shifts. And hopefully my students will go on to mentor other students. And that's how change happens, right, with people with ideas who share their ideas with other people. So it's the work that I do with my good students here at University of Michigan. And that is how I'm hopefully living my big life.
Awesome.
I think living a big life for me, I'm going to be pretty literal, is being unafraid to take up space. Mm-hmm. Unafraid to take up space physically, emotionally, mentally. I think the pressure that is put on folks, women of color, to be small physically is a larger reflection on how we're expected to be on an intellectual level, an emotional level. And I think living a big life is to be able to be as big as possible and unafraid in all of those areas.
Yeah, that's amazing. Where can people get in touch with you and find you to learn more about your work or Mariki working with you? Kendrin?
So for me, the social media I use professionally is Twitter. So my Twitter handle is @KendrinRae. KendrinRae. You can follow me on Instagram, but you're only going to see pictures of my six-month-old. So if you want to actually know what I'm up to, go to my Twitter, and I'm linked to my professional website that sort of highlights my work and the work of my students and opportunities to get involved in research here. But awesome. Going through my Twitter is a great way to do it.
Perfect. Thank you. What about you, Petrilli?
Okay. So you can see a lot of the activism and work that I've been doing in on body liberation on Instagram. So you can follow me @the_bodylib, BODYLIB _advocate. Or you can join my Facebook group. If you search embodylib, two words, embodylib, you'll find me where I post content musings and feedback from other people on all things body liberation.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Petrilli and Kendrin. This was such a amazing conversation. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, Lena and I will talk about our biggest takeaways from this thought-provoking conversation.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kendrin, stay there. Ingrid, I'm so excited. I love this episode. This was a great episode. Really, I could talk about this for hours. Many, many, many takeaways from this conversation, but there are probably a few main ones that I would want our listeners to walk away with. And the first one is that weight stigma is a reality, and it has serious effects on our health. in the health of people with large bodies and small bodies, psychological and physiological health. I encourage our listeners to turn on their weight bias antenna and notice their behaviors, their self-talk, jokes, social media posts, conversations, and how these are perpetuating weight stigma, because this is affecting everybody's mental and physiological health. I also think that a big conclusion and something that I emphasize in the program and when I work with women is that we want to control our food because we want to control our bodies. And we weren't born thinking that fat was a bad thing. It's something that we learn. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like this learned self-hatred, right, towards our bodies. And nothing good comes out of shaming and inflicting guilt. Nothing good. Actually, the effects are harmful, and that doesn't lead to anything. I could keep going on, but give me your takeaways.
I think it's such an important conversation, and I think one of the biggest takeaways, and we talk about this a lot throughout our different shows, is health is so much more than your weight, and we need to stop taking off those blinders and looking at how we're feeling, because we internalize so much in terms of what our weight should be or what we should look like, that we're really not looking at the world in its fullest expression. We're just staying stuck in this. And how much more can we be doing if we are feeling well, if we're strong, if we're getting out and changing the world?
Yeah.
Let's get off of that and look at how we can add to the world and contribute to the world.
For sure. It's very this weight stigma is very limiting,
exactly.
Right?
It like weighs on you, and when your life is composed of thinking good or bad food, or should I eat this or shouldn't I not that, like how much thought space is taking up in our brains?
It's 2 years for women, the cumulative is 2 years.
I know,
for women.
I know.
So I just would want to close with one thought, and it's that we can promote physical activity, a nourishing diet, which includes pleasure, mm-hmm. sleep, stress management, without a single mention of weight, right? We don't need scales and numbers on the scale to want to do these things. Amazing episode. Definitely, we have so many more questions. We could do it again. If money is a source of stress for you, you cannot miss next week's episode. We'll talk about financial well-being and how investing time and energy into it results in a bigger, more fulfilling life. Our guest, Manisha Thakur, is a nationally renowned financial literacy advocate for women, and her work has been featured on the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and NPR. You cannot miss it.
Thank you so much for joining us. And as always, if you're like what you're hearing, please share with your friends and colleagues on iTunes. Give us a review. And if you have topic ideas or people who you would like to see us talk to, feel free to send us a message on Instagram. I am Ingrid_wellness.
And I am at live.well.way on Instagram as well.
Thank you so much. And we'll see you next week.
Bye.